when people call social services for assistance, sometimes a little financial help can make all the difference.
What we find is that you're much more likely to show up in the homeless shelter if you were unlucky enough to call on a day when funds were not available.
We talked to that researcher who used data from a Chicago call center to show that small amounts of money can be the difference between whether or not people become homeless. Also,
Most of the time when you think of engineers and computer scientists, you think of a man, and we know that with the proper exposure and awareness that girls can succeed in this field.
Girls can not only succeed, new numbers show a growing amount of women enrolling in Illinois University computer science programs. We speak to a U of I professor and student, as well as hear about a new Girls Who Code program that will soon start in Peoria. And finally, how community gardens can also be employment vehicles. That's all coming up on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. For people without some security in social and people without having security with social and financial resources, if they have a sudden event like a medical expense that's not covered by insurance, that can be the beginning of a downward spiral toward homelessness. Researchers at the University of Notre Dame evaluated the effectiveness and cost of one program that provides temporary financial service. The goal is to help people stay in their homes and out of homeless shelters. And they found that a one-time payment of up to $1,500 greatly reduces the likelihood of those people becoming homeless. This research was based on data from one call center in Chicago, Catholic Charities Homeless Prevention Call Center. The study was published last month in Science Magazine. Joining us now is one of those researchers, Jim Sullivan. He's an associate professor at Notre Dame and the co-founder of the Wilson Sheehan Lab for Economic Opportunities, and on the phone with us from South Bend. Hi, Jim. Welcome to the 21st. Jim?
Yes.
Yes, we can hear you now. Good morning. Also with us is Noreen Russo, the director of Catholic Charities Homeless Prevention Call Center, that call center we were just talking about. She's on the line with us from Chicago. Hi, Noreen.
Hi, Nyla. Thank you for having me.
Noreen, I think it's so interesting that there is a homeless prevention call center. How did that come about?
So a bunch of people in the city of Chicago came together and they said we need to do something about people going all over the city to different agencies and hearing kind of the same thing, the funds being available or the funds not being available. But they were kind of running around the city. And so some of the big leaders came together and said we need to have a centralized, coordinated place where people can call, get the same screening, and get matched up the funds and programs.
And how do you figure out who needs help? When people call in, what's the screening process?
When a person calls in, they all go through the same exact screening. We start with demographics, so basic demographic information, and then we kind of go more into the situational questions and kind of dig into what happened, what occurred to cause them to fall behind. What was that one little thing that might have made, you know, so as you mentioned earlier, like a medical emergency, that one-time crisis that caused them to fall behind. And then at the end of that, we try to match them up with the funding program that's available in the city.
Jim, what makes the Chicago Call Center unique in terms of how they catalog callers?
Well, one of the attractive features of it from the perspective of researchers is that they are centralized. So that allows us to get information on everybody who's seeking emergency financial assistance through the call center. You know, in other cities, you have agencies spread out throughout the city that provide assistance. And as Noreen suggested, that leaves the person on the brink of homelessness having to contact a bunch of different agencies, and that's bad for the person seeking assistance, but also hard from a research perspective because we don't have a centralized location that has the data necessary to study the program.
Okay, and because they asked everyone the same questions, I'm sure that sort of helped you in terms of filtering out and organizing data for the study and all the information you collected?
Absolutely. I mean, the screening process made the study possible. What they do when you call the call center is they have, as Noreen suggested, they ask everybody the same questions, and then we know who's eligible for assistance, and they keep that information, and then we know whether or not funding was available at the time that they called. And you know, the unfortunate fact is that funding is not available for everybody that's eligible for the assistance. But because we have information on who gets funding and who does not get funding, we can see what happens for these two groups.
Noreen, what kind of factors are involved when people call into the Chicago Center? How does that funding work? Are there times of the year, times of the month when maybe funding isn't available, or is it just based on the circumstance that person is in maybe and where that pot of money can come from to help them?
So on any given day, there's funds that are available and funds that aren't available, and it's all based on whether or not, you know, the state, federal, city funds are there. So this is really important. So at the end of the phone call, if we can't match them up with the funder program, they could become homeless without that. As the study showed, little amount of money of the $1,500.
Yeah, and I want to, Jim, in a minute I want to get to that $1,500 and how you arrived at that. But Noreen, I just want to stay with you for a minute and ask you about what kind of things. So when someone calls, I wonder, we talked about at the beginning, I introduced the conversation saying, for example, you could have a medical expense. Mm-hmm. What other kind of things are you hearing from people who are calling saying, hey, I need like $500 or I need $1,000 or I need $200? Mm-hmm. What are people saying?
Job loss, benefit loss, kid had a medical emergency, had to miss work, stuff like that. So it's really little things that, you know, the next month they are going to be able to pay because they have gone back to work or they're now getting the benefit back or they're...
So it's a short-term situation.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. And Noreen, how do you determine and how are people, what kind of programs are they matched up with in terms of providing funding for them? Is this something that Catholic Charities fundraises for, or is it more just a matching with different state, local, or federal programs that might be available to help them?
So, yes, it's state, federal, city programs that might be able to help them. We do not determine any of the regulations for the funder programs. We are given what the regulations are, and then we determine whether or not the person fits those criteria with our through the screening.
Jim, how many people did you look at for the study, and how long did the study take?
Yeah, so we got data from the Homeless Prevention Call Center for the years 2010 through 2012, and that ended up being, when we look at the sample of people who call seeking assistance for rent or security deposit, we had about 4,500 callers who were part of the study, and you know, some of these callers called when funding was available, and some of them called when it was not. And to be clear, all of the callers were eligible for assistance. So really, the only difference is kind of the luck of the timing of when you called. And we've been, you know, pouring through those data for the past couple of years, and came out with the results recently that appeared in Science.
And how did you arrive at that $1,500 threshold? There's about $1,000 to $1,500, correct?
Yeah. So that is determined really by the funding agencies. So different funding agencies will have a different maximum threshold that they will provide in terms of assistance either for rent or security deposit. When we looked across all of the people who would receive assistance, it was about, on average, about $1,000, just under $1,000. And the typical max would be about $1,500.
And what did you find in terms of how much money you think is saved through other programs by the short-term, providing the short-term assistance, say $1,000 or $1,500? I imagine that probably ends up saving more money down the line for other social service programs. Am I correct?
Yeah. So, no, that's very good. Let me kind of talk about the impact that this financial assistance has and why it's cost saving. So what we found when we looked at people who called when funding was available, and then saw, and looked whether or not they checked into a homeless shelter over the next 6 months to a year, we find that they are much less likely to check into a shelter than if somebody called on a day when funding was not available. And so really the only difference between these two groups is one called when funding's available and one called when it's not. And that difference, so getting access to funds, makes a huge difference in whether or not you end up in a shelter. The decline in homelessness is on the order of 75%. And then so it's costly to provide this assistance, but what we show is that the benefits are really quite high because, as you pointed out, if you don't become homeless, then you become less dependent on other services. So you're less likely to rely on cash welfare support. You're less likely to need housing assistance and other things. So when we did the calculation of how much is saved just on public benefits alone, it's on the order of about $5,000 for each person who is prevented from becoming homeless.
And I just want to go back to that 75%, just to reiterate mm-hmm. that point again. You said that people who were able to receive that funding, did you say they were 75% more likely to not become homeless?
Yes, it's a 75% reduction in the likelihood you become homeless if you receive that funding.
And I think you answered this question already, because I had a question about, it sounds like you looked at people over the long term, because what I was wondering is, are there instances of people who need the short-term help, but then they call back a month or two later and then maybe need the short-term help again? But it sounds like you filtered all of that out in the study as well.
Well, so what we did is we looked at first-time callers. So we see if the very first time you call, if you get access to funding or not. Now, some people will call back eventually and get funding, but these people are on the brink of homelessness, so they need to have to be eligible. They need to have documentation of being on the brink, which oftentimes is, say, a 15-day eviction notice. So if they're turned away for funding, when they call, they're much less likely, and we can show that, much less likely to end up getting funding. But the other thing that we did in terms of long term is we were worried that what it did is reduce homelessness in the short run.
Right, that's what I was wondering about.
Kicking the can down the road, and maybe they just all we do is prevent them from becoming homeless for 3 months, and then they become homeless after that. And so we looked a year later and 2 years later, and it was really remarkable that this difference persists. That they are still much less likely to have ever showed up in a homeless shelter 2 years after the call if they received funding as compared to if they did not.
And is it still 75% 2 years later?
Yeah, so the magnitude of the difference is remarkably stable over time.
Wow.
And that's what that points out, is that there is this short-term impact, and then that impact persists.
Noreen, I think the question that are in a lot of people's minds right now is, why isn't the funding available on certain days? Is it just the funding runs out and then it's just not there?
Yes, exactly.
I have to wonder about the state budget impasse situation. Certainly, we've had conversations on the 21st with Catholic Charities, Monsignor Boland, as well as other social service agencies, about how difficult it's been from the lack of funding or the delay in funding that they're getting from the state. How this data obviously was looking at a 2010 to 2012 period. What has it been like for you guys at the call center over the past year or so, with the volume of people calling? How many more people are you turning away now because the funds aren't there?
So exactly, it's had a dramatic effect because not only has it, there's no funds or programs to send a lot of the callers to, but we've seen a decrease in calls because the word has gotten out that there's a state impasse. And that's really scary to us, because we're wondering, now are those people homeless? Because we know that these funds are proven to work, and we know what the consequences of them not getting these funds and programs are to, us and to them and to society. So we just think it's really important here that the state does pass a fiscally sound budget that includes programs like this that are proven to work.
Noreen, I imagine anecdotally, we've been talking about the research of this, but have you heard back from clients who have received short-term assistance? Have you heard back from people about how much of a difference it made for them?
We don't do follow-up like that, but yes, we do get people who do occasionally call back and give us anecdotes and say how grateful they are. So that is awesome when that happens.
Jim, what's the next step for you guys in research on this subject? Now that you've seen this one study that shows this, what else are you looking at?
Yeah, so we're doing a number of different things. Most closely related to this is that, this study looks at one particular outcome, which is probably the most direct outcome. When you get this assistance, does it prevent you from becoming homeless? But there are a lot of other things once you become homeless that we know from anecdotal evidence might happen, and we can test that. So in other words, we know that once you become homeless, you're more likely to end up being arrested. And but we've never really had a good measure of what is the direct relationship between becoming homeless and being arrested. We can now test that and see, are people who call when funds available less likely to be arrested, say, 6 months to a year later? And so we're working with the Chicago Police Department to get data to link to the call center to see the impact there. Another one is that we know that when you become homeless, there are negative health outcomes. So are you more likely to show up in an emergency room if you call on a day when no funds are available? And that's going to give us really important information about these added social costs, because it's really expensive to serve these individuals through the emergency room if we could have prevented it in the first place by preventing them from becoming homeless.
Mm. That's Jim Sullivan. He is an associate professor at the University of Notre Dame. He's also with the Wilson. He's co-founder of the Wilson Sheehan Lab for Economic Opportunities, talking to us about the research he's been doing in Chicago and the homeless population and preventing that. I want to thank also Noreen Russo, who's director of the Catholic Charities Homeless Prevention Call Center. We'll tweet out the links to this study so you can see it. If you follow 21st Show on Twitter, we'll have it up at our website as well at www.21stshow.org. Jim, Noreen, thanks for being with me.
Thank you.
Nice to talk to you, Nyla.
Welcome to Back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. When we think of computer programmers, a stereotype that this is a job for men, but enrollment numbers at colleges across the state this year are showing a growing trend of more and more women joining computer science programs at colleges and universities across Illinois. At the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign's campus, women now make up 46% of the incoming freshman class studying for a computer science degree, and 37% of the department as a whole. It's the largest increase the university has ever seen in this area. We're joined in studio now by Professor Sarita Adve from the UIUC campus. On the phone with us is Lorraine Bryson. She's president of the Tri-County Urban League in Peoria. She started a Girl Who Code program to help get young girls interested in computer science. Also in studio with us, a computer science graduate student, Corley Leung. Ladies, welcome to the 21st. Thank you all for being here with me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Professor Adve, I wanted to start with you, Sarita. At the University of Illinois' Urbana campus, this is the largest increase that you all have ever seen. 46%, as I said, now studying for traditional computer science degrees. Last year, it was 24%. Back to 2012, we look at 6%. Why do you think we're seeing such a large increase in recent years?
So I think there are two issues here. So the first one is just it's becoming so evident now that computer science and computing are so fundamental to our lives. And computer science has become a central thing in all disciplines, not just the sciences and engineering, but social sciences, humanities, creative arts, everything. And so we've seen the number of applications to our program just simply skyrocket, both male and female. But now that we have so many women applying, these are all very highly qualified women, we can fill our classrooms with women just because we have so many applying. So that's one. But the other thing is, I think it's really important to understand that we've made a huge number of outreach efforts in the past. So this is happening at the national level as well, but our department, we've had programs at all levels of the pipeline. So for middle school girls, we have the GEMS program, which is a summer camp that we offer. You know, it used to be 20 girls. It was 120 girls this summer. We have programs for high school students where I think Corley will talk more about that. But this is the Chic Tech program where our undergraduate women go to high schools and talk to the girls there, demystify computer science, tell them what an amazing career path it is. And then we also have lots of programs once the girls are admitted. And again, I think I should let Corley speak because her organization is at the front.
Yeah, let's let Corley speak because I want to get into all of these aspects of the pipeline. Corley, can I ask you, first of all, before we get to the work you're doing, you're in graduate school, so before we get to the work that you're doing for outreach, how did you get in? What was the motivation for you to study computer science?
So I think computer science has a lot of different opportunities. And in high school, back in high school, I really like to volunteer in hospitals and like Red Cross, different environments. And for me, CS was kind of the program that if I didn't, I could help a lot of people in a lot of different areas. So that's why I did computer science. I was talking to nonprofits that were dealing with bullies in the United States. I was talking with nonprofits that were dealing with AIDS education for women in Africa. And it's just, I could be in U.S. and still be helping so many different people. And it's just amazing.
And what kind of outreach efforts are you doing now to get more people involved in the undergraduate program? And as Sarita was mentioning, all of the summer camp programs, what kind of things are you doing?
So there's, I guess, two main programs that Women Computer Science kind of work with. One is the Chic Tech Outreach that Professor Advi mentioned about. So that's a fall retreat that we have in November, and we invite around 50 high school students or 75 high school students this year, 50 from last year, and they just kind of come on campus for a two-day, one-night trip to see about what computer science is like when you're in college, not just about what everyone thinks it's like. Like, we don't just sit in front of a computer and code all day, but what other projects can we actually do, the cool aspects of computer science that most people don't really know about other than we sit in front of a computer. Mm-hmm. And something else that I did starting a couple years back ago was something called CS Splash, / Sail now it's called. And it's kind of like a day-long program that we just invite high school students to come to Siebel to take different classes that are taught by undergraduate students themselves so they can see that the different aspects of CS again and what we're like as regular humans and just not just the programmers that people often think we are.
Sarita, how much do you think this is a natural generational shift? Not just as you're saying, as everyone's thinking about degrees that are going to be useful in the future, degrees that are going to lead to employment, but then obviously just as we've seen more emphasis on young women being involved in STEM fields and seeing more female role models in the area.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, partly we see computers all around us, right? So social media, you know, smartphones, you see the number of things you do with computing. So that's, and this generation is growing up with all of this technology around them. I have an 11-year-old daughter. I mean, she thinks the internet has been around since, you know, the beginning of humanity.
Well, it's been around all of her time.
Right, exactly, right? And so certainly that's a big part of all of this. But, you know, it is important to understand that computing is indeed now a part of, you know, even the disciplines that people are thinking in terms of jobs, right? So having this computational thinking, as we call it, those skills, it's not just programming. It's how you think as a computer scientist that's really important now. It's just like reading, writing, and math. We need to do this. You know, President Obama announced the CS for All initiative, where he's talking about computer science across the curriculum from K through 12. So as this generation gets more and more exposed to computer science through daily life, through the schools, I hope to see these numbers rise even more.
That's Professor Sarita Adve with the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, where she teaches computer science. You know, you mentioned your daughter, and I wanted to bring Lorraine Bryson into this conversation. Girls Who Code in Peoria is just about to start. Lorraine, why do you think, as we're talking about, we've been hearing about high school students and how important it is to get high school students interested in college, but even before high school or at a younger age, we really know that there's sort of a critical time, what research has shown, that it's really important to involve young women into this. What can you tell us more about that? What age do you think is a really important age to get girls interested in having, maybe not necessarily interested, but just having more efforts and opportunities available for young women in this field?
Well, I think the earlier that you start, the better your chances for success. We really are trying to focus on that middle school, like fourth through eighth grade, that age group. And we have found over a transition of many years that we really need to focus on the girls. Beginning back in the mid-90s, the Urban League in Peoria started working trying to incorporate computers into our everyday offerings and our services that we offer. And we started with a program called Byte Masters, which just got people, we were just getting into computers and purchasing computers and getting a computer lab. And what we found from that were the young people that were in there, which were these middle-aged students, the boys took off. And they were really interested, and probably because of video games and those kinds of things. But the girls were kind of hesitant, and they stood back a little bit. So the next thing we tried to launch was a program called Power Girls, where we focused just on the girls. And we partnered with Women in Management, the local chapter here in Peoria, and they came in and kind of gave that career aspiration and how we use computers in management and in the workplace and how I use it in my job. So not only are we trying to expose them to computers, but also that career path. Mm-hmm. Being a community-based organization, many of our clients may not have access to computers at home. So they come to the Urban League to have that access. And our offerings have kind of transitioned over time to now we're with the Girls Who Code, and we're getting ready to launch that program. But we started this summer with a summer camp. When school is out, camp is in. And we work specifically with fourth through eighth grade students. We had boys and girls, and then hopefully the first part of next year we'll launch our Girls Who Code, because we really want to focus on the girls to get them involved earlier, get them exposed earlier, and build that foundation of support.
Lorraine, why do you think it's important to have spaces, based on all of the work that you've done as you've been explaining, do you think it's important to have spaces that are just female only for these young women?
I do, and especially at the younger age, when you're building that foundation, when you're showing them the possibilities, the opportunities that are out there. And traditionally, we've not only done it with computers, but we've recruited women in the building trades. You know, those non-traditional opportunities for women. And if you start when they're girls, by the time they become women, the sky is the limit.
Professor Adve, there's some research that shows that young women tend to drop their interest, or their interest tends to wane in computer science during teenage years. It's something, I know there's something female computer sciences professors call a leaky pipeline, and I wanted to talk about that. Just why, can you explain what that is, first of all, and at what ages we're seeing this?
Yeah, so by leaky pipeline, what we mean, as you said, is that at every stage, so elementary school, middle school, and then going on to high school, we have girls dropping out, and not only just at high school, but they get into undergrads, right? So now we have a much smaller fraction of women getting into undergrad. They drop out there. They drop out in grad school. They drop out
Enter the workforce.
When they enter the workforce, right? I'm a professor. They drop out at the assistant professor levels. They drop out at the associate professor levels. And you see, that's why we call it the leaky pipeline. And over the last several decades, the computer science community actually has risen to the challenge. I mean, I'm really proud of the work that we've done to address these leaks at every stage of the pipeline.
Can we talk about that, Corley? I wonder if you can share, when you came to U of I in 2013, I think it was just 17% of incoming freshmen were women. Now we're looking at 46%. What are some of the ways that you and other female classmates are trying to keep other female counterparts interested in staying in the field?
So as WCS, the organization, we do a couple of things that try to keep them in the organization. I think a lot of things that we've heard is that people leave because they don't feel comfortable in the field. And what we try to provide is a supportive community for them. When they're worried, they don't have to look at against a room full of men and be like, who do I actually talk to about these problems? And we provide them a community that they can talk to. We have different mentoring sessions that we do lean in circles, which is just a group of people similar age, similar level of technical skills or experiences that just come together and talk about what problems they're facing, how they're treating these problems. And we also have tech team, which kind of give different tutorials or technical skills so they can feel more prepared when they do enter the workforce. And we have ways for them to give back to the community so they can see the impact they're making. And when they do go into the workforce, they're not as scared or as intimidated by interviews by people who they're working with.
Did you ever consider dropping out of when, and now you're a graduate student, are there times that you thought, I don't want to do this?
Yes.
And was it because of being a woman or was it for other reasons?
I think it's a combination of reasons. Being a woman could be part of it. So personally, I wasn't a very outspoken or I wasn't a very confident person coming into University of Illinois. And I think that a huge part of it was my first class, I was surrounded by people who told me they had built apps and they had published apps on Android Play Store or on App Store. And that first feeling, and I learned one semester of programming before coming in, and that feeling is already extremely, extremely intimidated. Like, everyone knows what they're doing. They're not having problems. The homework is taking me, like, 10 hours. They finish in an hour or, like, even less. And that's just very intimidating.
Sure, yeah. How did you overcome that?
I think a lot of it was more of just focus more on yourself and than on other people. There are a lot of really, really smart people in this field, which is part of what makes it very challenging. And it's always changing, so it's fun. But at the end of it, it's also about yourself, how you feel about how confident are you about your technical skills instead of everyone who's around you. And I feel a lot more of it was just telling myself that this is a phase that will be over in a year or two, which is true. I feel like once I got past junior year, my third year of college, those people who told me that they were building apps since they were like 5 or like 10 and have apps published, our technical skills weren't that much different.
And Professor Odvig, Corley's been talking about students and student-to-student support. I imagine also there's an element of having more female faculty members and female professors available for mentorship. Where is U of I on that, and what would you like to see happen with more female faculty members within the computer science department?
It's interesting you asked this because we have female faculty. All faculty are involved in mentoring undergraduate students. But over the past few years, all female faculty have been assigned to female undergraduate students for mentoring. And just recently, I got an email from the person who handles us saying, you know, we have so many females now. You guys are just, you know, you're not.
Start assigning them to the men also.
Yeah, okay. Exactly. So that's great, right? But we do have, you know, these types of mentoring relationships with female students. And you know, the way I look at it, my door is always open to, I love to talk to women. This has been sort of a crusade almost, right, for many of us senior people, because we are so used to being the only woman in the room and so don't want the next generation to see the same.
Lorraine, I wonder if you can end by just letting us know. You said Girls Who Code in Peoria, as we're thinking about that next generation, your hope is that that will begin early next year in Peoria?
Yes, that's our goal. We're we've got our designation. We're getting ready to start recruiting students, but we're also looking for volunteers to serve as assistants as well as kind of the leader of the group. And once we get that in place, then we'll be ready to launch. And we're hoping by the first of the year that we'll be ready to go.
That's Lorraine Bryson. She's the president of Girls Who Code, as she said, also with the Tri-County Urban League, talking about this effort in Peoria. I want to thank also current computer science graduate student at the University of Illinois, Corley Leung, and Professor Sarita Adve from the Computer Science Department at the University of Illinois for joining me. We've got more information about this at our website. Ladies, thank you for being with me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. A model for urban community gardening in Chicago has taken seed in other parts of the state. The idea is not just to have community gardens, especially this time of year when everyone is reaping the benefits of all the months of their hard work, but also to use these gardens as places for employment and training. We're joined now by two guests who are spearheading some of these efforts in Illinois. On the line from Chicago, Alicia Feistemel is the case management coordinator of Growing Home. That's a nonprofit organic farming social enterprise that provides employment training and organic produce to communities throughout the city. Hi, Alicia.
Hi. Thank you so much for having us on the radio today.
Yeah, thanks for being with us. In studio with me here today in Urbana is Nicole Bridges. She's with the nonprofit Prosperity Gardens. Their aim is to provide low-cost, locally grown produce as well as provide job training to at-risk youth in the Champaign area. Hi, Nicole. Thanks for being with us as well.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
Nicole, I wanted to start with you because I just mentioned one of the programs you do provides at-risk teens a job to work in the garden. What's that program about?
Sure. So we provide employment opportunities for at-risk youth in our community, that's Champaign and Urbana, to have workforce development opportunities on our farm. We have 32 raised beds on 2 city-owned lots, and so we use the farm as a vehicle during the summer to provide employment opportunities to those students. I would say 90% of the students that come to us, Prosperity Gardens is their first job. So we spend time doing some really simple soft skill development training with the students in the beginning. And then once we get past that point, have the opportunity to dig deeper into that program and integrating that program into the farm work that we do.
And what inspired you to create this program?
Many things inspired me. I was a Peace Corps volunteer and served in Zambia, Africa for several years. And when I came back to the Great Recession, I saw the effects of poverty, of food insecurity that is affecting people in the community that I grew up in. I'm from Champaign. And there was an opportunity to utilize some city land and create a garden space for it. And immediately I had spent so much time trying to find a job after my service that I could feel the pain that, you know, younger people are feeling in trying to attain employment. So we were really excited to forge the relationship that we have with Ready Program. You know, on the offset, we had an educational relationship with them, but over time, we were able to grow that into offering employment opportunities for between 4 and 6 youth each summer. We also offer opportunities to work on the farm in the spring and the fall after school.
Alicia, when we connected with Nicole to have her on the 21st show, she referred us to your organization in Chicago because she said she's learned a lot from visiting and learning about farm-based employment training programs that you guys do at Growing Homes. What are you all doing?
So we are actually a job readiness program as well in the Englewood community, which is the most probably impoverished neighborhood in Chicago. And we train about 50 people every seed growing season, and we take clients from all walks of life. They could be fresh out of high school and haven't had any job opportunities, or they might have spent many years incarcerated and have been released and they're on probation or parole. So we work with a wide range. And while they are here at Growing Home, we have it's a 14-week paid job opportunity where they actually spend every day on our urban organic farm, and they start the process from seeding to weeding to tilling to harvesting to actually processing all of the produce and then selling all of our produce at 4 local markets. And one of those markets is actually on site at Growing Home at our Wood Street farm. So we're trying to provide better food quality at a discounted rate for our neighbors and also Chicago worldwide, so that these opportunities can be given to them. We take link cards. That's been very helpful for our neighbors to participate in our fresh produce. And while they're learning the farming aspect of it, we also do 7 weeks of job readiness training where they are in our classroom and they're really focusing on what their sense of purpose is, building up their self-confidence, their self-esteem, and really just letting them know that they are the expert of themselves in whatever they would like to pursue, whether it be food service or warehousing or going back to college for like nursing. We are there to support them, and a lot of times that's just what they need. They just need that stepping stone to the next part.
Alicia, how do you pick the people? How do you select the participants, and how many applicants do you normally get a year?
We are very selective in our hiring process since we only take 50 people. So each year we can have up to about 900 people interested who have called and said, I'm interested in the program. And what we then do is invite them to come to an informational session. And from there they apply. They do a handwritten application. We review the application. We select people from there who we would actually want to interview. And then we take about 15 to 20 people for each cohort, which we offer 3 every year for 14 weeks. So we start in March and we end in October.
Nicole, how many people do you have applying for your programs, and how many? And you, I think you mentioned the number. Is it about 5 to 6 that you guys are working with?
It's about 5 to 6 that we work with during the summer, and then that changes during the spring and the fall. We may have between 2 or 3 kids in the fall, and about that same amount in the spring. So I'd say per year we are offering about 10 youth in the community part-time job opportunities. Out of that 10, we work very closely with the Ready program, the teachers, the staff, the social workers there to identify students that would be a good fit for Prosperity Gardens. And last year we had a list of, I believe, about 27 kids that were interested in the position. So last summer it was a pretty competitive process. We interviewed 15 kids and we ended up selecting 4.
And I wonder, you've mentioned the Ready program a couple times. Can you explain what that is?
Sure. The Ready program is and it's an alternative middle and high school for students in Champaign and Ford County. It is an alternative school for kids who have had multiple suspensions or been expelled from their home schools. So it is it's a regional alternative education program.
Nicole, what kind of things did you learn from Growing Home in Chicago that you've applied here in the Champaign area?
What I loved about Growing Home, one was it's a very, in the Englewood site in specific, which is where we visited, it's very neighborhood based. It's right in the middle of the neighborhood. And I don't think there's anything more important than having your program be very visible to the people that you're working with. We were impressed by their farm, the physical farm itself. You know, when you're farming in the middle of the city in Chicago or in Champaign, you're dealing with a lot of blight, you're dealing with a lot of soil issues. And so I was very impressed with how they actually grow on their site in an urban farm capacity. And then lastly, their employment program is just, you know, very inspiring. They're reaching 50 people a year in this really intense program and really being able to improve the quality of life for the folks that come through their program. And for us, we are on the cusp of inheriting an acre from the city of Champaign where we're going to have some more space. We're going to be able to offer more employment opportunities in that way, and hoping to really, again, use that model, that employment model that is used so well at Growing Home, and really incorporate that into to the things we're doing here in our community.
Alicia, I know you mentioned your program you have people coming who are formerly incarcerated, sometimes people who, whether it's misdemeanors or felonies or people who are on probation. And I know one of your employees from this season, Ricky, who had just been released from prison earlier this year, came to work from Growing Home. I wonder what kind of impact the program had on Ricky in particular and other folks that you're working with.
Every time he comes back at least every other week. He just graduated in August, and he'll come around every other week, and just he's just so appreciative of the opportunity that we looked past the background, we looked past his history, and we saw the potential in him and how motivated he was to have this opportunity to change, to transform. And when you talk to him, he says nothing but, oh, thank you, Growing Home. It means the world to me. Like, I just love you guys. And being able to really sense, like, how much our participants grow is an amazing feeling, to see them evolve over the 14 weeks and even afterwards.
I was going to say, so after the 14 weeks, do people have an opportunity to have other employment with you?
So we do have some opportunity. Three of our farm staff have actually graduated from our program and now are full-time Growing Home staff. So there is opportunity. One of our graduates now, that she graduated in June, she's actually working with our outreach department and doing outreach events. So there are different opportunities. We have one that's working as a farm market assistant for the farm stand. So there's definitely opportunities to work for us or with us in the future. But our main goal is to really help them find permanent, full-time, long-lasting employment that's sustainable over time. So with Ricky, for example, he's working at a warehouse. He's making above minimum wage. He has a 401k. He gets paid time off. And those are things that we really strive when we build our partnerships with employers, is to make sure that it's not just a dead-end job, that there's really room for growth and advancement. Because we truly believe that our participants are worth that, and that's what we strive for with those partnerships.
Alicia, do you have other, have you heard from other community gardens across Illinois or other places across the Midwest who are interested in developing similar programs like how the folks in Champaign have done based on kind of similar things to what you guys are doing?
I think we definitely have an area in Englewood where they are focusing on community gardens and trying to implement similar to what we're doing, but we do it at such a high production rate. We have 5 hoop houses. We're working all day, and all we do is focus on produce. So I know there is talk about how can we implement this somewhere else. I just personally don't know.
And Nicole, I wanted to ask you. Sure. Yeah. Nicole, I wanted to ask you. Alicia mentioned that the produce gets sold in Chicago in a couple different areas. Where do you all sell the produce from the farm in Champaign?
Right. So our students that we hire in our employment program, they're working on the farms doing those same kind of things. They're seeding, they're harvesting. And then my students also participate in 2 markets in Champaign. We participate in the Land Connection Champaign Farmers Market on Tuesday nights in downtown Champaign. So our students really get an opportunity to develop customer service skills, be able to develop marketing and entrepreneurship skills through that program. In fact, the last week that I had all my students in the program, they said, "Miss B, get out of the booth. You know, you're stifling business. We've got this."
That's great.
So, and then we Prosperity Gardens also runs a program called the Mobile Market. The organization purchased a short bus off of Craigslist. We worked with the University of Illinois professor, Mark Taylor, who's an architecture professor, and his students, who actually outfitted that bus as a mobile market. So we move all of our produce, our tents, everything in this bus. And currently, our partner is with Francis Nelson, located on Prospect and Bloomington Road, our local health clinic here in Champaign-Urbana. On Wednesday afternoons, we're there selling our produce a little differently than Tuesdays. We've set up this mobile market program to be able to increase affordability and accessibility of the local foods that we grow. So on Wednesdays, the market is set up. We tell folks that they can take what they need and pay us what they can. So families are able to take as much produce as they need, really just for the change in their pocket.
Okay. And I know that both of you have fundraisers coming up this weekend. I know, Nicole, there's a tour that kicks off tonight for people in the, who want to see the Prosperity Garden tour at 5:30. Alicia, Growing Home has a fundraiser coming up this weekend. We'll tweet out all of that information. Unfortunately, we're out of time for today, but we'll tweet all of that out from the 21st Show Twitter handle. We'll have it up at our website at www.21stshow.org. I want to thank Alicia Feistemel, the case management coordinator with Growing Home, as well as Nicole Bridges with Prosperity Gardens. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you so much.
That does it for us today. On tomorrow's program, we'll be talking about the partisan debate over same-day voter registration in Illinois. As always, you can go to our website, www.21stshow.org, for more information. 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Have a great day. Thanks for listening.